This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Journalist Jack Germond is our guest this afternoon. He's been covering politics for some 40 years. He began his career in 1951 at the Evening News in Monroe, Michigan. He also worked at the Washington Star and the Baltimore Sun. He's covered every national election since 1960. Germond has worked as a bureau chief in Washington, an editor, and a columnist. Today, he serves as a panelist on the television show Inside Washington and as a commentator for National Public Radio. He quit writing the column he had written with Jules Whitcover for the Baltimore Sun following the last presidential election. When he called it a day on the column, he and Whitcover had written more than 6,900 columns. Germond has written a book about the stories and the people he's covered. The title, Fat Man in a Middle Seat, 40 Years of Covering Politics. In the book, he tells readers, for every good story, you spend two or three rainy Friday nights at the airport trying to fly standby and ending up as the fat man in the middle seat. The book is now available in a paperback edition with a new chapter on the presidential race of 2000. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. Jack Germond, good afternoon. Welcome.
How are you, Celeste?
I'm fine. How are you?
Very good.
Good. How did you decide to make 2000 your last presidential campaign?
I started growing increasingly sour on the quality of the presidential campaigns and the candidates. And 2000 was sort of, I became very stuffy all of a sudden. I thought to myself, what am I doing trying to choose or trying to explain, parse the rhetoric of George W. Bush, trying to figure out who is the real Al Gore every time he changes his shirt. And I decided this was really not a serious work, and I wasn't enjoying it, so I decided I'd quit it. And I'm still doing some work. I'm still writing some pieces, but not that often.
Yeah. Not a big fan of George Bush, the president.
No, I think he seems like a nice enough guy. I just think he's a very light. You know, they used to have a phrase in New York politics, he's so light he could walk on a Charlotte Russe, which is a very meringue-y dessert. And in fact, I think that's still true. But I wasn't a fan of
Al Gore either.
Of Gore either.
Yeah. What's your assessment of President Bush post September 11th?
He's shown a marvelous ability to voice the feelings of the country, say the right things to please the people at the coffee shop on the corner, and elsewhere, the whole country really, in response to these terrorists. I think he's been magnificent in that way, and I think he's sort of wandering into trouble now, because you can only go along so long saying everything is terrorism. Which he's sort of essentially doing. And he's also being exposed a little bit by his passivity on the Middle East. I mean, what's happening in the Middle East is it's riveting, and it's so important and so dangerous. And you can't just sit there and let that go by. It is, the notion that you can let this go by and then you're going to go back and attack Iraq is laughable. And I'm afraid the president hasn't judged this correctly. I think he's made a classic misjudgment. It's not doing any particular harm politically right now, but I think it might be in the long run.
Mm. You write that these two candidates in the presidential campaign of 2000, the two major party candidates, both ran totally contrived campaigns. Those campaigns, to what extent, can the media cut through those contrivances, and how could the media do a more effective job?
Well, it's very difficult. I mean, I make the point in the book that what's happened in presidential politics is that there's incredible growth in the amounts of money available. Once they have all that money, they use it to hire more and more consultants. Consultants tell them what the people want to know. They run to the head of the parade and say what the consultants tell them, and you have this. And television fix it up, and that's all that matters. In fact, good newspapers, I must say, public radio, too, for that matter, but good newspapers in particular, do cut through the contrivances, I think, very well. The fact is, though, that most people don't read newspapers for that. They don't read all those long, detailed stories. They're dull, you know. And people are not serious enough about politics. They should be, but they aren't. They think they understand the campaign if they watch it. A couple of debates on television. Mm-hmm.
I would imagine it's got to be somewhat frustrating to be on the bus today covering major candidates.
Yeah, well, this is. I haven't spent much time on the bus the last couple of campaigns. Going back and forth, I have covered them, but not on I haven't been doing the daily story, which drives you crazy, I would think.
Yeah.
Because the candidates are. The candidates are so programmed, and they're so they worry so much about getting out of the. Let me just put it this way: they worry so much about showing any humanity or spontaneity. It's very dull stuff.
Well, showing that humanity or making a slip of the tongue can be so costly.
I know, and that's partly our fault in the press. I mean, we do exaggerate. We make too much out of these little flaws, much too much, I think. And we spend a lot of time. A lot of reporters spend a lot of time playing gotcha politics. I mean, gotcha journalism. They're trying to get some of the candidates to say something stupid so they can hang them with it. And it doesn't really tell you much. It doesn't tell you. It doesn't tell you what the candidate is like. It doesn't tell you all about the things, what kind of people would the candidate have around him, what kind of appointments would he make, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I don't know how you get around that, to tell you the truth.
Yeah. You tell a story in the book about Gary Hart and his wife appearing. I can't remember now where they were. And he made a gaffe about of New Jersey.
Yeah, that was in 1984. And he was contesting Walter Mondale for the Democratic nomination. And there were two big primaries coming in California and in New Jersey. And if Hart had won both of them, he would have won the nomination. And his wife was campaigning in California, mostly because he was already well ahead there. And he was campaigning in New Jersey where it was, he just pulled ahead. It was about 10 days out. And he went out to California to do a little campaigning and went to a party at a one of those Hollywood parties with a very wealthy Democratic contributor up in the Hollywood Hill. It was a beautiful, beautiful view, and it was a nice, beautiful night, as they often are. And he made a crack about how he and his wife had divided the campaign, and she got to go to California, and he was in New Jersey, and she said, I got to hold a koala bear the other day. And Gary said, I don't want to tell you what I got to hold. It was a toxic sample from a toxic dump or something.
Mm.
Which was a crack about New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Well, New Jersey is very sensitive to slights and so forth, and this became a huge cause, just a wise crack. And it cost him the primary there, and it cost him the nomination. And it really was just a wise crack. But you can't do those. The press was all over screaming about it. And Mondale was crying all kind of crocodile tears and demanding that Gary Hart apologize to the people of New Jersey and et cetera, et cetera. All nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Jack Germond, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, your calls are invited. Questions and comments, welcome. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. A listener is waiting to talk with us on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Jack, you may or may not remember me, but I shared a couple of square feet with you in Washington some years back. Jerry Landay, I was with ABC at the time.
Yeah, sure.
How are you?
Very good.
Good. You're sounding fine. I have two questions to ask for you. The first one is, you pointed out, I think correctly, that George Bush is not looking good on Middle Eastern policy right now. And, of course, that's where a significant percentage of our oil and gas comes from. And it could hurt a lot. But my question is, this is not post 9/11 anymore. It may be another country. I'm wondering, how long are his coattails going to be in the congressional elections coming up? They didn't prove to be quite long enough in California. And the second one is, how, coming out of all this between 2002 and 2004, do you think the right wing of the Republican Party, which has been driving Republicanism for so many years, is going to fare in all of this?
Well, on the coattails questions here, two coattails, voters, presidents have very little in the way of coattails. If they can skew turnout by, you know, presidential year, that may help. They don't have any, you know, even Ronald Reagan in a midterm election couldn't, in 1986, couldn't re-elect some senators who were bad candidates. So I don't think the coattail thing is important. The right wing has done very well. George W. Bush had a very good candidate in one sense. He managed to sort of mask under his sort of hail fellow well-met manner a very deep obeisance to hardline conservatism. But we've seen it with his appointments, particularly John Ashcroft. And not just John Ashcroft, but Ashcroft in particular had a great many sort of second-level appointments. So the right wing is getting the fundamentals, the religious right, or whatever you want to call them. They're getting a lot of successes out of this administration, a lot of toys, so to speak. But I think they've done very well.
Do you think they have legs the man in power, who is supposedly their standard bearer, runs into situations where he has to compromise increasingly on a number of and curb the bite into the ideology that seems to drive the right?
Yeah, it does. But on the other hand, to their way of thinking, he's certainly preferable to any Democrat. And I think in the long run, they're going to swallow it and go along. Just like, you know, a lot of liberal Democrats, you know, were not enamored of Bill Clinton in 1992. But,
or 96.
You know, or 96, but they took him.
Jack, I wish you well. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. 333-WILL in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-WILL. Journalist Jack Germond is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. The so-called horse race coverage of campaigns has come in for a lot of criticism. Those stories report on the question, who's winning? But you say you like those stories. You think they're important. Why?
Well, I mean it's, you know, I've been arguing about this from editorial writers and political scientists who have been abusing people like me on this question for my whole life. But, well, first of all, you know, if you're covering a political campaign, the first question people ask you is who's winning. If you're a reporter and you don't answer the first question on the reader's mind, you might as well be covering the school board. I mean, there's no point in covering it if you're not going to deal with the central question on the people's mind. On the other hand, it is unnecessary to. You can cover horse, you can do horse race politics, so-called, but it's unnecessary to ignore other factors that go into the campaign, because you deal with issues and personalities and tactics and so forth. Terms of the horse race, which is what they're all there for. I mean, that's what people are talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the candidates are trying to do, is to use issues in a way that, you know, you look, for example, at a campaign, all of a sudden they'll start talking about a particular issue involving, let's say, childhood nutrition. And what does that tell you? That tells you that their polling has shown they're weak with women with young children. And they need to strengthen their credentials there. Now, that's part of this horse race, but it's also, you know, tells you something about the candidate.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can combine the two.
There's a great quote from Adlai Stevenson in the book, "The first duty of a politician is to win election."
That's right. If you don't get elected, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with another listener on the toll-free line in Mattoon. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. It's always interesting to listen to everyone's opinions about the way the presidents, whomever they are, especially the press. How would you suggest that he handle this Far Eastern problem that we're into. I know he did handle the 911 here at home really well, but yes, I'm getting a little tired of us getting to the point where I don't think we know where we're going because we've got him holed up over there, but we don't know what we're going to do next. Just like to hear his opinion of what he thinks the next move should be.
Well, I mean, I would be misrepresenting myself and everybody, anybody who suggests they have a real answer to the problem in Israel is fooling you. On the other hand, what you do know is that right now you have to avoid a conflagration. You have to avoid an Israeli attack so harsh on the Palestinians that it becomes a wider war involving other states in the region, and that is a very serious danger, I'm afraid. And the only way to do that is for the president himself to get involved in a very active way in trying to arrange some kind of a ceasefire. At the very least, it involves getting Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, involved, if not the president himself. And it is not enough just to say that Arafat is a terrorist. And it's not enough to say that he hasn't done enough to stop the suicide bombers. Those things may be true, but you've got to do more than that to stop them. And the other Arab states, I'm sure, would welcome a more active Bush role. And he also has to say, he also has to see what kind of limits, if any, Sharon is going to put on the military action by the Israelis. It's a very difficult.
Yes, it is.
It's a very difficult issue, but it's not one on which you can sit by, I'm afraid.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next we go to a listener waiting to talk with us in Charleston on line one. Hi.
Hi. I had a couple of questions. I was wondering, myself, I'm a pro-life Christian, and every time I hear the word right-wing and things like that, it kind of, in my mind, says to me that my opinion is kind of radical, and to me, it makes perfect sense. And there's talk of, like, the candidates being canned, but the news seems canned when groups of people are pretty well categorized and as unintelligent, whereas people who are pro-choice or are in other areas, they seem to be the ones that have some good thought process. And to the coverage of the news, I'm sorry to kind of blend everything together, but there was President Bush's trip to China had gotten so little coverage, and part of his speech was so good, but it never really got aired hardly anywhere.
Well, I'm always interested in when conservatives complain about being identified as right-wing, as if this were saying this was the moral equivalent of some corrupt position. It just describes a political position. I mean, those of us who use right-wing and left-wing is used a lot too, do it mostly for shorthand purposes to try to identify where people stand on a bunch of issues, pro-life, pro-choice being one of the issues. Abortion issue being an obvious issue, but there are a bunch of them, and the right wing and left wing are used in that sense. It doesn't necessarily suggest anybody is in a morally indefensible position that I can see. Conservatives. The fact is, the only people who are using any kind of moral judgment right now are those who are accusing the pro-choice people of being baby killers. And that's the only case I see where either side is using that kind of a judgment.
Well, I don't see stories on, like, crisis pregnancy centers, areas like that where this side is accused sometimes of not caring, but this side offers pregnancy tests, offers adoption. If you're a white person looking for a white child, that's almost impossible because of the rate of abortion for white children. Just things like that. just are kind of like ignored by the press, and they're a whole area that, that could, you know, really bring a lot of improvement to our country if, you know, the area of life issues is really discussed in them in a thoughtful way. And you know, our terms of maybe baby killer, I don't think nobody in my circle ever uses it.
I've watched a lot. I've seen a lot of tickets from the pro-life tickets outside of meetings involving where there were liberal, left-wing, Democratic candidates, and I've seen them use it. Many times.
Okay.
I do not see the reverse.
Maybe that's my like the apples to oranges though. When you come down to the people coming in contact with the real people that are going for abortions, that is not done in that way. The reason being that maybe there's more license is because it's political, and you feel like, well, my freedom of speech entitles me to say, you know, what I want to say or maybe make it drastic. But when it comes down to really putting something down that would benefit another person, it's a totally different story that is never told, that the pro-life side is a side that goes out and brings finances to the people, has them have their children, supply them with supplies for their children, things like that. So, you know, there's just a whole untold story, you could say, that gets lost in making one side, I think, maybe look good and another side look bad.
Okay. Jack Germain, you want to comment? And I'm going to take the caller down now because I think we're losing that connection.
I understand what this gentleman is saying. There's a lot of this is just an argument. I mean, I don't know what source of information he uses, what newspapers he reads, and so forth. I frequently hear people complaining that they never tell us about something, but where in the world do they learn about it if we haven't told them? You know, somebody had to tell them.
Mm. How did you and Robert Novak become friends?
We met way back in the 50s, covering stories together.
Really?
And he was a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and I was working for Gannett, and we covered politics together. And we remained friends all these years. We don't agree on any issues at all, but we're personal friends. We do agree on, we have the most important thing in common, which is our work, and we share a lot of views about that.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a good friend. He's somebody that if I needed $30,000 tomorrow morning, he would say, what size bills? He's a good friend.
You were very lucky as a young reporter to have worked for the Evening News of Monroe, Michigan. You were 20-something. Would you tell us what you learned from the owner and the publisher of that paper?
Yeah, that was a marvelous experience. The paper had 20,000 circulation, a little under, actually, and the publisher was a man named J.S. Gray, and he was the paper, it was my first job. Well, I had a brief job as a sports editor. It was my first real job. And I discovered, he was a man who was just absolutely untouchable, incorruptible in every way. And people tried to muscle us around. And here we were. And J.S. would not allow that to happen. We had, I tell the story in my book about this. One case, I got on a story about him. Detroit Edison Corporation, buying up some land where we thought they were going to put a nuclear power plant in our town. And they were trying to suppress the story, and I was invited up to have lunch with Walker Sisler, who was the head of the chairman of the board of Detroit Edison, at the Detroit Club. And the thing that was posing about, I'd never been to a place like this. This was just one of these all red leather and banquettes and walnut walls, dark paneling, this club, and he was this very impressive executive surrounded by several others, all very assured and self-assured. And here was I, 23 or 24-year-old reporter, sort of, as people describe us, shabby little men writing in notebooks. And I was bowled over, but the guy really leaned on me about the story. And said it would be an unfriendly act if we printed it. And I went back to the publisher and told him what Walker Sisler had said. And he picked up the phone and called Sisler back and told him we were sometimes wrong, but we were never unfriendly, but we were going to print the story anyway, and we did the very next day. And it was just, you know, I thought that was the way all of the newspaper business was. Well, it isn't, unfortunately. The way all good papers are.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener in Urbana on line two. Hello.
Yes, thanks. I was just wondering what's your guest's sense of how valid the polls are that are used, and you know, and what do you think about how they're used in general?
Yeah, well, you've hit on a tough topic on which I'm a little bit of a crackpot. I think there are entirely too many polls. We seem to quantify the obvious every day, and I think we use them. I mean, polls are valuable. There's no question. If you're a political reporter, you like to have access to polling data and to see what people are interested in and so forth, which issues are important and so on. But the problem with this is that we use the polls too uncritically, and there's some sort of dirty little secrets about polls that we don't tell the readers clearly enough. One is, first of all, that the refusal rate in polls, people who won't answer the questions, has been rising steadily in the last few years. In the last 10 or 15 years, sometimes it's as high as 30% or 40%, which gives you a skewed sample to begin with. The second thing, and this is perhaps more important, is the level of ignorance in the population is incredibly high. I mean, you get questions and you get question about, let's say, about the Middle East, and you have opinions from 85% of your sample, the people who give you an answer to a question about the Middle East. But in fact, probably only 20% of the people who answer the question have read anything about it, know anything about it, followed it all, except in the through headlines. It is, you see that all the time. It is. That's why the polls are so volatile, because so many people are not paying attention, and all of a sudden they pay attention. I would like to see, there's no way to turn this tide back, I guess. I would like to see news organizations be a little more selective in using polls and stop trying to see the thing that really bothers me. I won't beat this horse to death, but the thing that bothers me most about them is that when you have polling numbers all the time, you tend to see every activity or every action by a politician through the prism of those numbers. If the politician is doing well, and does something in particular, you interpret that act in terms of what the polling numbers show. That's not always the case by any means. It's misleading.
Well, and since there's no, I find it. That they're kind of dubious, because there's really no way to check that. In fact, you know, everything's on the up and up. But
I think most of them. I mean, there are a few poll takers who are making a good living who are real fakes, but most of them are pretty legitimate. And the one thing you do have as a check and balance in this field is the fact that there are so many, because if the data from one poll or another is very inconsistent with others, then you start looking at their methodology. And the good poll takers, I will say, the good poll takers will share with you their methodology in great detail, so you're able to find out what they're doing, and, whether they're asking the right kind of questions and so forth.
Well, let me ask one quick question, then I'll hang up. I was just wondering if you wanted to mention perhaps you thought that one particular news source was particularly underrated, and maybe you'd like to blow their horn, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
I don't know. I don't know what you mean by news source underrated in terms of. I think see a lot of politicians who've been underrated. I think, and I make this point in my book, The Thing. We're accused in the press of having too much influence over presidential politics. But I've covered every presidential election since 1960, and beginning of 1960, and there's never been one election in that whole time when either party nominated the candidate I would have preferred, not once. And most of the time, the one I would have preferred would have been the choice of many of the people covering politics. So our influence has been vastly overrated. And the people you would like to see president, if I could have chosen a president all these years, I would have chosen Howard Baker, the senator from Tennessee. But he never got off the ground. And that is sort of generally the case. The people we like are too reasonable, I think.
Mm. There were two candidates in the 2000 race who were pretty interesting, Bill Bradley and John McCain. What happened to their campaigns?
Yeah, they really were interesting. That was a fascinating year because Bradley made a terrible mistake by going into the Iowa caucuses because he couldn't win there, and he ran a bad campaign there. He still only lost by about 4 points up in New Hampshire. He could have turned that around and beaten Gore if he hadn't gone into Iowa. That was a terrible mistake. John McCain was really a phenomenon, and the fact is McCain required prolonged exposure. He was a guy that he grew on people that saw that he was just saying what he thought all the time, which people could hardly believe that. Imagine that. And the trouble was that he did better, particularly after he won the New Hampshire primary by 19 points. The Republican Party establishment didn't like him, and they sort of rose up against him. And in primaries, where only Republicans could vote, that became very difficult for McCain. And he made some mistakes, of course, but he was he did give us an example of how a campaign should be run. And the American people will respond if they see that. You know, so they don't see it often enough.
Bill Clinton is back in the news. He's said to regret his pardon of Mark Rich because it has tarnished his reputation. What do you think about that?
Yeah, the pardon thing was such a stupid thing to do. So he was feeling his oats those last few days in the White House, and it was self-indulgent. I thought Bill Clinton, when he came along in 92, I knew him going back to 78, I thought Clinton was going to be a dynamite president. He understood the issues. He was smart, worked hard, and so forth. He became so, self-indulgent is the word for it, and he was certainly in that second term. I thought he was the kind of president that in the second term would spend his popularity to do some things that needed to be done, like finding a permanent solution to the formula for Social Security and Medicare, which needs to be done. It's a very important problem facing the country to assure those funds operate adequately over the long haul, and he didn't do that. Instead, he spent his time with his giggling intern. It was pretty... And the problem with Clinton is that his entire life, people doted on him. His mother, who I knew and liked very much, his mother doted on him. Teachers in school, his school board, the draft board at home, everybody doted on him. And in his adult life, except for 2 years, his entire adult life, he either held office or was running for office. And he was always surrounded by young people cleaning up after him, staff. And they, when he got into scrapes and made messes and so forth, they all took care of it. And when he got to be president, he couldn't do that. He couldn't get away with it. Not with the Monica Lewinsky story. And that's why he was such a terrible disappointment.
In his column yesterday, the Washington Post's Howard Kurtz estimated that the former president could gross about $40 million in his first couple of years out of office. Now, I know there's a multi-million dollar book deal out there for him and fees for speaking, but $40 million?
Yeah, that sounded pretty high. Even Reagan didn't do that well. He can get a I guess Clinton can do one of these. He can get a big book deal. He can go get some, do one of those Asian speaking tours where they seem to have money they're not doing, they have no use for. Asian Middle Eastern speaking tour. I don't know where he gets the rest of it. Somebody's going to, you know, some law firm will obviously take him in as a managing partner or an off counsel partner. I should say not managing partner, off counsel partner, and give him some big guarantee. But the funny thing is that Clinton's not a guy. Clinton's never been a money grubber. He didn't have a lot of expensive taste. Let me put it that way. He wasn't like that at all. His money's it's obviously better to have it than not to have it. But that was not what was a driving force for him.
Mm. Well, speaking of the Washington Post, do you still refer to the Post as the OP?
No.
The other paper.
The other paper. No, we're all reminded of that now because of Jim Bellows, our editor at the Star, those great days at the Star in the late 70s. His book is coming out shortly, and it recalls the OP. For your listeners, won't know this, but the Star on the was competing with the Post. We had a gossip columnist who wrote a column called The Ear, Diana McClellan, and she referred to the Post as the OP for other paper in her column all the time. It became known, and it was something we thought of for a long time.
What was it like competing with the Post in the days of Watergate?
Well, it was,
must have been hard, really.
Well, at first it was terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, because they were just killing us. I mean, they were killing everybody. They had, as I said in the book, you had these, we were all, Bob Wood was a good friend of mine now. I play poker with him almost every week. But I can remember at the time, I thought he and Woodward and Bernstein were a couple of punks on the city staff of the Post, and they were killing us on this story. They had all the sources, they had all the information, and they ran all over us. And as the story went along, we all got a little piece of the action after a while, and the story got too big just for any one paper. But the Post did a hell of a job on it, there's no question. And I went to the Star in the middle of that, and had the advantage at the Star of not having been one of those who've been beaten into submission already, so I was able to go do the second half of the story on fairly even terms.
Mm.
The denouement, I should say.
Let's talk with another listener. On line one in Urbana, good afternoon.
Hi, Jack. I wanted to ask you about your take on the Ralph Nader campaign in 2000. Those of us that were involved in it, I think the press coverage was extremely unfair, and we were polling over 5% until the last 3 or 4 weeks of the elections when the Democrats turned on us with every gun they had.
Yeah.
Now, here in Urbana, we got 10% of the vote. And, tell me what you think. I'll hang up here.
Well, you won't like what I think, because I think it was terrible. I think it was a real ego trip by Nader. I've known Ralph a long time, but this was a real ego trip. And the proof of it is, I think you can deal with the Nader campaign. Nader's whole premise was it didn't make any difference whether you elected Al Gore or George W. Bush. Does he really think that Al Gore would have made John Ashcroft the Attorney General? I don't think so. I don't think so at all. Does he really think that he would have try to put Charles Pickering on that Circuit Court of Appeal? I don't think so. The fact of the matter, it does make a difference. And the Nader couldn't win. And all he did was cost Gore the election. He cost him Florida, and he cost him several other states. And I thought that was mischievous, to tell you the truth. And I think it's misguided for people to think that the major parties are so impure they can't stay with one or the other.
For their book, The News About the News, Washington Post editors Leonard Downey and Robert Kaiser interviewed the network news anchors. And they asked the anchors what it was they were about. And Tom Brokaw said, right off the top, to survive.
Yeah.
Do you see changes on the television news front that will impact political coverage?
Well, they already impact.
Oh, sure.
They already have a huge
Right.
In fact, I mean, they set the agenda. What's happened is they have devoted less and less attention to politics. And going back to the time about 7 or 8 years ago when Jennings was riding high on the ratings, Peter let it be known that he didn't like politics very much. And so all the others said, well, he's leading the ratings, he doesn't like politics, so let's not do so much politics. So they cut back. And they did. And they assigned fewer people. You go up, like in the New Hampshire primary, and you don't see a network correspondent. You see network producers, you know, young people going up there. And then the network crew will show up at the key moments, but they aren't there all the time as they used to be. The other thing that's really impacted is the cable channels, though, which are just, you know, constant blah, blah, blah. And as one of those who blah, blah, blahs, I shouldn't be complaining, I guess. But it is, we're sort of talking the subject to death, I think. And I don't think we get more people. You know, where you get people interested is if you have a good contest or if you have a candidate who catches their fancy. If you find more candidates like John McCain, the things that are wrong with the political system will correct themselves. We don't have many. We need more candidates who will tell the consultants to push off. You know? They almost never do.
What do you think about all those panels and pundits on television today? What's the value of that programming?
Well, having done it for 20 years, I can tell you the value is to put my daughter through Duke and then medical school. I did it for the money. And the fact is you can't ignore television if you're in the news business. I mean, it's ridiculous. I worked for CNN for a while. Had a contract to do 50 things a year for them. And I do a show now and occasional other things. You need to reach people of any way you can. I don't think that the talk shows, though, of which I am one, I'm on one, I don't think they contribute anything special. I really don't. I think they're nice for the political junkies, but the most you can say is they sort of outline the parameters of the argument. I mean, on the program I'm on now, Inside Washington, Charles Krauthammer is our most conservative analyst, and I'm probably the most liberal, and he and I, between us, we sort of define the outline of the views on a particular issue. And it may be valuable that way, but only for people who don't read anything serious or listen to anything serious. Mm. If you read a good newspaper, if you listen to All Things Considered, you know, a morning edition, you know, you don't really need talk shows. Mm.
Got one last question for you, because we've got to wrap it up here. Any advice for picking a winner at the track?
I am working on that assiduously a couple of days. I'm going to be very shortly going and buying the racing form tomorrow so I can go back tomorrow on the horse of the Gulfstream. And I have not found the magic solution. If I had, I would stop all sorts of lives. Stop writing books and talking on television. Mm.
Thanks for talking with us this afternoon.
I enjoyed it.
Jack Dermond has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's written a book about the stories and the people he's covered in more than 40 years of journalism. The title, Fat Man in a Middle Seat, 40 Years of Covering Politics. The book now available in a paperback edition with a new chapter on the presidential race of 2000. Dermond is also the author of Blue Smoke and Mirrors, How Reagan Won and Why Carter Lost the Election of 1980.